Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. On the programme today, we'll be sharpening our minds with the best of Paris's photography exhibitions around this year's Paris Photo Art Fair, and we'll be settling in for some binge-worthy entertainment, I'm assured, as Netflix and Amazon release some of their big shows in time for the darker evenings, and maybe some fairly dark days, quite frankly. Joining me in the studio are Kathleen Fox-Davis, founder and director of a new gallery space in London, Black Box Projects, and Toby Earl, TV editor for London Live and the Evening Standard. Elsewhere on the programme, we'll meet Jamie Hewlett, the man who brought the virtual pop group Gorillaz to life through his famous illustrations, as he releases a retrospective on his work, and we'll of course have this week's global countdown. All that is ahead, so do stay tuned. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Thank you very
Thanks
much.
For
Good
having
to
me.
Have you with us. Before we put our feet up in front of the TV with you, Toby,
yeah.
We're going to get a whistle-stop whirlwind art tour of Paris from Kathleen Fox-Davis. Kathleen, you're freshly back from the French capital, of course. It's one of the big events in the photography calendar globally. Paris Photo. However, you say
Rome.
Potato, exactly. in the Grand Palais, the world's largest art fair dedicated to the medium. I guess a big overview, first of all. How was this year's offering for you?
Well, this was the 21st edition of the fair, and the fair could not have been more different, more grown up from the way it was originally envisioned when it was in the basement of the Louvre and people walked through smoking their cigarettes, looking at tiny vintage photographs that these small dealers from around the globe brought to Paris. This is now a big showstopper fair. I would say it has equal parts photography galleries and contemporary galleries that were bringing their photographic artists with them, which does change the mood. It changes the price point, the sort of client that's walking around, and also I think a little bit of the competitive nature. Everything is amped up a bit. This year had 160 galleries from 30 countries, plus another 32 booksellers on stands, and then they had their own independent showcase shows around the fair as well. Karl Lagerfeld was the guest curator, guest of honor, and he went and selected 200 of his favorite pieces from the fair, which added a little bit of an extra treat as you're walking through these different booths of galleries that you may or may not know, artists that you may or may not know, and seeing what Karl Lagerfeld thought was the very best of the best. But I want to focus on two galleries specifically that I thought chose to do something a little bit differently. The first one was Ingleby Gallery. There were 26 galleries from the entire fair offering that chose to do solo shows, which is normally a bold way of going about the fair process. Normally you take little bits of everything so you can appeal to everyone. Ingleby pulled out all the stops and did two solo shows where they did a complete rehang halfway through the fair. One was Ben Kauke, the other was Gary Fabian Miller. Gary Fabian Miller, probably one of the best known photographic artists of the past three decades. Ben Kauke, new. He's been working for 15 years, quite quietly from his studio in Berlin, but he's from New Zealand. And this was Ingleby bringing this to us, this amazing discovery. Both artists are working completely in unique objects, which is quite unique for the photographic medium. Both are re-envisioning these early 19th century processes where photography was more alchemy than technology, and where photography really was rooted in the time of enlightenment and science and industry, but also a time when people were deeply spiritual and superstitious, and there was an aura of the mystery around what a photograph could do. Ben Kauke is working in amber types, tin types, collodion wet type processing, and they are glass negatives. So the negative is the image you're looking at. Gary Fabian Miller, it is basically light painting. So he is in the studio making beautiful, transcendent images of color on these unique pieces of cibachrome paper. So that was one to definitely stop, spend some time, revisit halfway through the fair, because you were going to miss it if you only came for the Monday and you weren't there for the Saturday. There was something new to see. Another gallery that I thought took a bold choice was Gallery 51. They have a new artist who's only been working for 5 years, but only had been exhibiting for three, any sort of international platform. And his name is Bruno Rolls, and they dedicated an entire wall to his unique photographs as well. He's working in silver gelatin prints that he hand makes, and it's the idea of copying and the value of a copy. So focusing specifically in these works on a palm tree and what a palm tree is. And the series is called A Palm Tree is a Palm Tree is a Palm Tree. And it's very tongue-in-cheek, but it's this concept of how we see, what value do we put on things, questioning the literal concept of photography in itself, that he's playing into the idea that it is a copy. And that's one of the things that sometimes devalues the idea of the photograph, because it's not unique. It's not a unique painting. It's not a sculpture that an artist has made with his own hands. But he's taken these images that he creates, he's cropped them, he's made them again and again and again, and formed these amazing multi-image compositions of conceptual just wonder. You stand in front of them, you wonder what in the world's going on. The titles are very tongue-in-cheek, and I'm excited to see where this artist is going to go, and I think Gallery 51 will do well showing us in the next edition of Perifoto next year.
Definitely. Well, it's exciting to see, as you say, young talents particularly, and then, you know, if galleries choose to then ally those with some established players as well. It's always an intriguing combination. Can I ask you a little bit about another focus of the whole of Perifoto, which was cinema, and we'll talk a little bit more about this, but there's sort of a film and video section. Now, I guess for the sort of purist, you often get this feeling like, oh, well, hold tight, what's this doing there? But did that sort of ease its way in very neatly? Was there a coherence to that?
To be very honest, there was not a coherence. I know that for the press day, the film area was not even open, and I spent 4 days at the fair, and quite honestly, I never saw it.
That doesn't sound that coherent.
It's not coherent, but there were lots of elements to the fair that you simply couldn't get to, even if you spent every single day there. Sure. But with that said, it does show a little bit of where the photography market is going. You have photographers that they don't want to be called photographers. They want to be artists. They want to be contemporary artists or conceptual artists. So they're really blurring the boundaries of what you can do with the medium of photography and how you can push it. And I think the fair is doing well to embrace that. I hope that it doesn't alienate those galleries that are bringing the incredible vintage pieces, because Paris is the place for that. I mean, you saw at Christie's with the new Man Ray world record of a piece that was valued at 1 to 1.5 million euros going for over 2.6 million. And, you know, this is the place for people to bring those one-offs, those amazing vintage pieces. So I hope that there's still a place for both of those to sit side by side.
Well, let's sashay on out of the Grand Palais halls, out into Paris to see what else is going on. And maybe we can talk a little bit, Kathleen, about an artist, I think, who delivers a real technical tour de force. We head to Marion Goodman Gallery, the Japanese photographer Hiroshi Sugimoto on show, renowned for these monochrome photographs. Seascapes is this particular exhibition, The Focus. Tell us a bit about this. And this is quite interesting because, well, again, there's a sort of cinematic angle with the London show, which
is happening in tandem.
But maybe tell us a bit about this show, first of all.
The Hiroshi Sugimoto show is called Surface Tension, and it's on at Marion Goodman Gallery through the 22nd of December. This show is amazing. You wander through these windy streets of the Marais. You stumble upon the Marion Goodman Gallery, and I was so shocked and surprised. It was my first visit by what was inside. You've got 14 seascapes, four sculptures by the artist. Doesn't sound like it'd be all that much, but this was akin to a religious experience. Wow. The way it's been, the way the exhibition has been conceptualized in that space. You walk into this silent, almost dark space where the only things that are lit are these perfectly sublime seascapes with. You've got the horizon line that's joining it as a circle all the way around the room. And you go into the basement, this deep cavernous space, and you have even more of these seascapes. Some are gray tones on gray tones, some are black on black. They are sublime. And it was a real opportunity because with this artist, you see small works normally, you see in multiples. You see one or two large works being showcased with a gallery, but you don't see the amount right in front of you. He's working with the idea of the infinite, this sense of passage of time, particularly with Snow White, the complimentary show in Marion Goodman's London Gallery, the idea of a shared experience and memory and what we take with us, with his theater pieces. This is a show not to be missed. I actually got to see Sugimoto's sculptural pieces for the very first time, and they are amazing. And this is also an example of a photographic-based artist moving outside of the traditional photography medium and creating something that is unique and amazing and quite special to encounter. That's what I would call this experience. It was an encounter.
Tempting stuff. Wow. It's interesting, Toby. I mean, often people talk about, when they talk about artists, and often for photographic work, and they use that, they say, oh, they have a very cinematic eye. And it's interesting, as an expert in the silver screen and the small screen yourself, I mean, that presumably particularly appeals, because these are artists who show a mastery of light and shade, which is very resonant for the moving image as well.
Of course, and absolutely, you know, these artists are capturing these perfect moments, these still images which exist within themselves and outside of themselves. They can be looked at in isolation and be held up. And of course, you get a lot of filmmakers as well who maybe try to have those images which kind of really grab the attention, maybe sometimes quite rapidly, you know, in order to kind of build a kind of stylistic sense. But then of course things like plot get in the way, and it kind of disrupts whatever flow or style was existing beforehand. Because you often find, I don't know if you find in films, there might be, say, in the first 10-15 minutes, very stylish, lots of punchy visuals, a lot of things happening, a lot of great images being burnt onto your brain, and then that kind of has to ease up because you then have to start telling a story. I very much enjoy photography. I very much enjoy, particularly, you know, we've got some of these here about the driving and whatnot, and I like the idea of recording the experience of looking at moving images through an image. And I'm a big fan of photography, and I'm a big fan of those images which kind of just grab you and arrest you and hold your eyes.
Well, some of those are very arresting. Just briefly before we move on this, Kathleen, I know that there's basically the whole films are exposed, aren't they, in these drive-through images.
It's the
amazing technique.
Exactly. He has captured the entire film in one shot.
I mean,
so it's a long exposure.
Imagine how much more efficient you would be reviewing film and TV if you could do it like that.
I mean, that is a heck of a way to transcribe a film.
And I should also mention, if you're particularly fascinated by Hiroshi Sugimoto and his work, he'll be appearing on the pages of Monocle magazine sometime soon.
Nice.
On My Last Meal feature. So one of our friends will be speaking to him in Tokyo. So one to definitely look out for, exactly, to hear more about his art. Both those exhibitions, Surface Tension and Snow White, are put on by Marion Goodman and run through to the 22nd, as you mentioned, Kathleen. Let's pop into Next Level Gallery in Paris, finally. The American photographer Chloe Sells exhibited in a show called The Form That Strength Has Left. As with Sugimoto, another artist concerned with horizons. We talked about that already, Kathleen. Tell us a bit more about her. These are very ethereal and wondrous images, aren't they?
These are. Chloe Sells, The Form That Strength Has Left, showing at Next Level Gallery through the 23rd of December. These were all taken on the salt flats in the Kalahari Desert of Botswana. Chloe is an American-born artist, but splits her time between Botswana and her studio here in London. But just a little background, the salt pan is over 30,000 square kilometres that used to be the largest inland sea in Africa. It's basically now roughly the size of Switzerland. From my reading, I've never been there myself. But from the images, you do get a sense of how vast this space is. She originally went to this space to photograph the birds, the wildlife, the flamingos. But how she describes it is she went for the birds, but she stayed for something that was more for herself. In this two-year period that she photographed this area, her husband got very, very sick with a very aggressive cancer and died, but not before leaving her pregnant with her first daughter. So this was an immensely emotional, traumatic time that she sought refuge and solace in this space, the space that is quite unforgiving. From sunrise to sunset, there could be 20 degrees Celsius difference in temperature. There's very little shelter. What can survive there? It has done it by a miracle in itself. And she found her own salvation there through this meditative process of walking and of capturing the horizon line, literally chasing the sunrises and sunsets, where she said was something either starting or ending. And that horizon line that runs through this show, The Form That Strength Has Left, is the inevitable of the birth and of the dying of life that we all have, but also the beauty and wonder and all of the messiness in between. And so these works, that's the background of these works. That's how the pictures were taken. Then she goes back to her studio in London and she manipulates them. all of these are hand printed and processed in her studio. In the pictures, you see what she saw. You see the horizon line, the dry, crusty bed of the salt pan, or when it was during rainy season, when it was filled and it just looks like an endless sea. You see the landscape, you see the birds and the animals, but then she has gone and painted them with different color exposures of the cyan, magenta, of yellow. She has added ink, she has added paint, swirls of chemicals, and she's created her own meaning and her own feeling and an experience into these works. So you're looking at what she literally saw, but you also are seeing what she felt as she was creating them. And the way it has been exhibited at Next Level Gallery is also quite special. Much like Tsujimoto, you have the horizon line connecting all of these works. So in each image, the horizon is at a different level in the composition. So the works are actually hung at all these crazy different levels to make sure the horizon line matches up and is one continued line throughout this two-roomed space at Next Level. And it's just gorgeous. This is the first show for Chloe Sells with her Paris gallery. She's also represented by Michael Hoppin here in London, and she is definitely one to watch, quite young in her career, but each new rendition of series that she creates, it's better than the last.
A huge emotional power.
Yes.
And there's a sort of poetic, elegiac quality to the works, and indeed, Kathleen, to how you tell us about them.
Oh, thank you.
Chloe Sells, The Form That Strength Has Left, is on at Next Level through till the 23rd of December. Thanks for a whistle-stop Parisian tour, Kathleen. All good. Let's talk a bit about television, Toby. We're going to discuss a couple of forthcoming shows this month. Let's get the ball rolling with Amazon's The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Now, this is created by Amy Sherman-Palladino, the woman behind Gilmore Girls.
Uh-huh.
Lots of people will be excited, probably on the strength of that alone. Tell us a bit about the story of this one.
Well, this formed part of Amazon's pilot season, where they release a bunch of pilots, say to the viewing audience, it's in your hands, you can decide, you vote for the ones you think we should make a series of. And of course, that automatically makes people feel more connected than a network splurging out a series. And you have to sit and go, well, will I like this? Because obviously people have had a little nibble and think, okay, I'd kind of be into this. You do have the feeling, however, that the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel from, like you say, the team behind Gilmore Girls, never in doubt. They had these guys aboard. They were never going to say to them, sorry, guys, there just wasn't the response we thought.
There are no sure things, but this was kind of a sure thing.
I think it was kind of a sure thing. If you got the creators of the Gilmore Girls on board, I mean, of course, Gilmore Girls came back to Netflix recently, a massive amount of publicity around that, huge amount of hysteria around that. This, you know, right now, there's a lot of conversation about comedy and about for probably the reasons comedy would not like to be spoken about, because it's about men and abuse, and also how difficult it is for women in comedy. So let's go back to the 1950s, where you can imagine just how hard it was. And so The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, set in New York in the 50s, it's about this Mrs. Maisel, Midge to her friends. She has it all. If you've seen the pilot, she has it all. She's got a husband. She's got a great place in New York. Kids, everything. It's the 50s. You know, it's that kind of 50s lifestyle that that period pushed American citizens towards. That American dream of having it all. And then, of course, if you have seen the pilot, spoilers, apologies. The husband's been having an affair. The wheels of her life fly off in every single direction, and one night she finds herself down at the club where her husband had previously been performing some stand-up until she found out he'd actually been nicking Bob Newhart's material. She finds herself back at this club, a little bit loose, she's had a bit of juice, climbs up on stage and just lays the audience flat with this searing improv where she examines her own life and her own lack of current success. And that is the show's jumping off point into into the first series, which comes along on the 29th, I think it is.
29th of November, I gather, yeah.
And Rachel Brosnahan plays Midge. Is very... it's very rare for someone to burst onto screen and to kind of put their arms out of the screen, grab your ears with their fingers and just pull you into the screen. But she does, as Midge. She is a tour de force, because the dialogue is rat-a-tat-tat. It evokes 40s, 50s screwball comedies as she careers around New York trying to kind of make sense of her life. And also, could I could I do this as a career? Could I actually maybe do this? And so the first series, the first episode of this first series is about her kind of realizing maybe I can. And it just accelerates. Each episode absolutely tears along. And it's funny. Most importantly, a show about comedy, it's funny.
Which is, and you know, because that's the risk you take. Just on that point, you actually started by talking about obviously this backdrop to sexual misconduct allegations in Hollywood, and there's this sense of an industry that's looking in a very sort of introspective way, quite rightly.
Yeah.
In a strange way, this is, you know, a female-led comedy, some really strong leads, but there's a bit of levity. Is this sort of what the business needs in a way? I mean, or is that too much sort of additional pressure to heap on it?
I don't think so. I think it could it be accidentally the right show
for now?
Right time.
I mean, it could quite purely be that this program has emerged or will emerge at the back end of some weeks of terrible news of appalling behaviour, and shines a light on Rachel Brosnahan and Alex Borstein and the rest of the cast, and shows off stars in waiting, potentially, you know, particularly Rachel Brosnahan, as someone who is now sort of moving to the forefront of this next set of comedians or comic performers who can go up to go alongside like Amy Schumer, Pola. Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably hugely coincidental, but it's unavoidable to discuss that because of the nature of the material and what's happened recently. And look, Amazon are not mucking around with this. They've ordered a series. They've ordered a second series before the first has even come out.
Oh wow!
They know. They know that what they've got here is a. And I don't want to say the word product because that's, you know, what they trade in. But it is. I mean, it is a great piece of hashtag content.
Okay, well, let's take a listen. Here's a little clip. Let's hear some of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
15 years I've been working in clubs, okay? Twice have I seen someone deliver the goods.
What are you talking about? Talking about your act.
I am a mother.
I don't have an act.
And you will when we're done.
Hi, everybody.
I heard some uptown chick got arrested doing a set.
What's the crime?
Simulating a sex act while on stage.
That's bullshit.
Mrs. Maisel!
This comedy thing, it has to work.
I'm gonna count to five.
One.
That's the end of my show, folks.
Two.
Tune in next week when my grandmother steals
three,
my pearls and fucks my boyfriend.
We charge for pictures now.
There's something here about miming a whore tickling a man's testicles.
Oh, I did.
Oh, yeah,
do that.
She did. It was fucking funny.
That's The Marvellous Mrs. Maisel. Apologies for that. Some robust language. Available on Amazon, as Toby mentioned, from the 29th.
Sorry to interject very quickly. It's really interesting in that clip. I should have mentioned this as well. To us, tame. To us, completely tame, given you know, the freedom of expression now. But it is astonishing. And I've interviewed the cast and sort of talked about the freedom of expression contained within this. And, think about it, it's not that long ago, really, particularly as an emerging performing art. It is insane that people were being arrested, locked up for just speaking, just talking about themselves, not even about anyone else.
But it was women talking about their experiences and themselves, which is a big difference.
Also, hence the Lenny Bruce connection as well, and the fact that, of course, he was part of that vanguard of saying controversial things. But absolutely, of course, women too, of course.
Let's turn next to Netflix, where next week a new show will be hitting screens. It's called Godless. This is a Western set in the New Mexico town of La Belle in the late 19th century. Mining accident claimed the lives of most of the male inhabitants, meaning that a town is governed mainly by women. As news reaches them, a notorious criminal, one Frank Griffin, is on his way to the town. The women band together to defend their home. Interesting, Toby. We're sort of picking up on some kind of similar things. Let's take a quick listen, and then I'll ask you about some of these resonant images in a second. Let's have a listen.
Where are the men at?
Dead. Bam took them. All of them.
How has the town fared without any men around?
Someone's got to look after things around here.
A town full of ladies. Bang, bang. It's ripe fruit for the wicked.
Frank Griffin's been looking for Roy Good.
He's gonna kill anyone that Roy Good loves or cares about.
The good people of Creed let him walk their streets. Now they don't have no streets.
When he finds out who's living here,
God help you folks.
Mister, we're a lot fucking stronger than you think we are.
Wow, the commissioners, they're like seers. This is another thing which was surely just the right thing to be on screen in 2017, no?
It is purely I mean, genuinely, purely coincidental, I've picked out these two programmes, which happen to be airing within a week of each other, and they both feature at the very front stories about women and about women in charge. And in particularly here, this is interesting, a Western town where there's a matriarchy. You know, it is almost unheard of, but godless, yes, it is set in and around La Belle, as you said, a town where a mining accident has taken the lives of pretty much every male inhabitant. And so this town is kind of just not quite withering on the vine, but it's not flourishing as other places which had a mine would be doing at the time. I should mention the cast. Jack O'Connell is in this as Roy Good, an outlaw on the run. Jeff Daniels playing a bad guy, this Frank Griffin, which is a great thing to see. You know, I'm a big fan of his work, and so to see him as a villain is great. He's also not scenery chewing, which would be so easy to be as a Wild West villain. And Thomas Brady Sangster plays the deputy sheriff. Let's also talk about Michelle Dockery playing Alice.
A couple of Brits, or British Oz. How's the accents? I always wonder straight away.
Good.
Bang, on Absolutely. Point.
Sound exactly like they did in the 19th century in the frontier towns. To my ear, sounds yeah. exactly the same. Unimpeachable. Merritt Weaver, who plays the wife of the mayor who died in the accident as well. So you have this town that's being run by women. This outlaw, Roy Good, who's taken in by Michelle Dockery's character, living on a ranch outside town. And Frank Griffin, as you said, yeah, remorselessly hunting them down. Now, this is a very familiar scenario. However, I found it to be, and I find it to be, a very invigorating spin within timeless environments. Mm. You have all the staples of the Wild West, of the lore and of the legend. But this is telling a different set of stories. It's referenced in the trailer there, the town of Creed. That is how what you see what happens to the town of Creed at the very beginning, and you kind of get a sense of the evil that men do. But there's something about, and this is not to sound reductive, there's something about this show's simplicity, which, again, I found so refreshing, because we have a lot of high concept programs, whether it's things, and again, this is not to denigrate when it's like Black Mirror or kind of any high profile, particularly drama at the moment, where there's kind of dealing with these like big ideas, and it's couched in a way in which kind of, you know, it's kind of requires, and this is, again, not to be reductive, a lot of attention investment. This is kind of simplistic, and I mean this in a good way, black hat, white hat. And I'm not saying that doesn't change as characters' motives develop over the course of the series, but you have a town here of women who just want to get on. Then you have some guys come in who want to take over the mine. Guess what? They ain't good guys. What do they want to do? They want to pillage. They want to take away what is rightly the women's, and they'll do whatever they can. So you have a lot of commentary, really, on greed, on capitalism, and also out and out wickedness in the shape of Griffin, and also redemption with Good too. But Michelle Dockery's character Alice lost her husband, has had a son with him who is half white, half Native American. So yeah, guess what? There's also some racism in the show as well. And of course, as you can imagine, in a town where in a place where it's there's a matriarchy, there's some sexism too when the outsiders come in. So when I say it's simplistic, I don't mean it's simplistic, but you are it feels as if, and it is kind of, you feel as if you know who you're rooting for, and I don't know how you find watching TV sometimes. I quite enjoy these shows where you kind of think, I'm on their side, I'm sticking with these guys. I don't know if
absolutely well no I don't think there's anything pejorative about simplicity if you're talking about a potent narrative. I mean, I don't know about you, Kathleen,
but it just sounds like pure pleasure.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it is.
Easy
it is.
To consume, but some big themes and ideas that resonate in what's happening in greater society. Mm. But you can sit down and actually enjoy it without feeling just bowled over by having to keep up.
Yeah. This is what I mean, you know. And I'm a huge Western fan, by the way. I think Deadwood is the very pinnacle of the genre. But when you have a landowner like Alice, played by Michelle Dockery, and she's got a rifle, and there's a trap full of men coming to take away what's rightfully hers, I know whose side I'm on. Like, there, you know, and straight away, and you want to see justice meted out. And I think that's also quite a psychological valve as well. Mm. Like, here's a land where justice can be done, and it might be the most brutal possible, but within the context of the show, I think you're allowed to enjoy the justice that is meted out to the men who would commit the most wicked and the most depraved acts.
Get your fix of justice being meted on Godless. It hits Netflix on the 22nd of November. Now, just before we have this week's Global Global Countdown, we're going to meet Jamie Hewlett. Hewlett's an illustrator best known for his cult 90s comic book Tank Girl, of course, and for bringing the members of Damon Albarn's virtual band Gorillaz to life. He's just released a book celebrating 25 years of his work, and he told our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco all about it.
I've been thinking about doing a collective book for quite a long time, and I had been approached in the past by people from different publishers, but I had never really been that interested in doing it because it required me to put it together, to source all the artwork, to lay out a book and to write everything. And so I wasn't really ready or that excited about it. And then 3 years ago, I decided I was ready. Tash and Meek, the most beautiful books in the world, and I love what they do, and I knew that they would do that with my book if I could go with them, and they have, so I'm really pleased with how it looks. I didn't want some sort of A4 size soft cover sold at a petrol station kind of book. I wanted a real book, and they've given me a real book, so I'm very happy with it.
Jamie, before we talk about, you know, your more recent projects, what was your first work, I mean, in your field? I heard you used to work for a zine called Atom Tam?
That was a fanzine that I did when I was at art school with Alan Martin, who used to write Tank Girl, and an artist called Philip Bond. And the three of us created Atom Tam, which we used to photocopy it on the art school photocopy machine, and we sold it for 50p. But my first professional work, my first paid job, was working for a magazine called Commodore User, which was a monthly computer magazine. And I used to do one illustration a month, black and white, just to go in the magazine somewhere, whatever, to do with Commodore User. And I'd get paid £50 a month. I did that for a year. It was my first job until Tank Girl came along.
And, of course, after the zine, there was Tank Girl, which had a huge impact, you know. It's film, such an influence in fashion magazines. Tell us about the creation of Tank Girl, and were you expecting that type of success?
Well, the creation of Tank Girl was the two original editors of Deadline magazine were Brett Ewins and Steve Dillon. Both of these guys are now no longer with us, sadly. But Brett Ewins came to my art school to give a lecture. And after the lecture, I obviously approached him because I was a fan of his work. And I offered to take him for a beer. And we spent the whole afternoon with him. And we got on very well. And I showed him my work. And he really liked what I had to show. And he said, listen, I'll stay in touch. And then 2 years later, he contacted me and Alan Martin and Philip Bond as well. And said, I'm working on a comic book called Deadline. I'd love you guys to come and work on it. So we had a meeting with him, and I took a portfolio of drawings and recent stuff up, and there was one drawing in my portfolio which I had done of a woman with a shaven head and a machine gun, and I called it Tank Girl, and I'd stuck a photocopy of a tank in the background. And he said he loved it, and what was it? And I said, I don't know. And he said, would you want to turn it into a comic strip for this magazine? And I said, sure. And so then we created Tank Girl pretty much on the spot. That was right at the moment when we had this big comics renaissance in England, where suddenly comics were very hip and trendy. First time, actually, in England that comics were considered hip and trendy, and the last time. And Tank Girl came out pretty much as that was happening. So we were part of this sort of new wave of comic artists and writers. You know, we were in all the fashion magazines, and it became very popular. And Tank Girl was an instant hit. And that was kind of the launch pad for everything, really. We had, I think, 5 or 6 years of doing Tank Girl, and it was big. And then they made the movie, and then they killed it. And then it was over.
You're talking about being popular. I mean, wait until we talk about the Gorillaz. I mean, that was such a fantastic project. Actually, I do remember when the first album came in. It was something very fresh and new in the pop scene at the time. And you were roommates of Damon Albarn, actually. That's how you guys met.
We already knew each other, but we didn't like each other. That was the... he was the frontman of Blur, and I was the guy that did Tank Girl. And because we're both Aries, and we're both born exactly the same... Well, we're born 10 days apart the same year, so we're very similar in that respect. You know, we're a little competitive. So he didn't like me because I was having success with my Tank Girl project, and I didn't really like him because he was the handsome front man from Blur, and I really liked their music. So there was always a sort of a negative space between us whenever we met. And then for some reason, after knowing each other for like 10 years, some reason we just suddenly started to get along. We ended up sharing an apartment in West London, and we had a lot of parties and a lot of fun. And we realized that after sort of not being nice to each other for 10 years, we realized that we actually got on hysterically well and that we should work together on something. And we threw a few ideas around that weren't really very ambitious. And then I think one day we were just watching MTV and looking at all of these terrible manufactured bands. I mean, that was like the heyday of manufactured bands, that everything was manufactured then, boy bands and girl bands. And if you're manufactured, then by rights you should be able to be quite spectacular because you're manufactured, it's not real. You have a songwriter, you have a costume designer, you handpick the band members. I mean, you should be able to make something really, really spectacular. But everything we were looking at was terrible. So we said, why don't we manufacture a band? Do it properly. And but let's make it a cartoon band, because that's even more outrageous, because, you know, the music industry is so elitist that they're going to hate that. So let's do it. And that was a challenge for us. And then we got excited by that. And I think instantly for Damon, he saw this as an opportunity to experiment and explore his love of music, because it wasn't Blur and it wasn't him. It was these four characters, and that allowed him to work with whatever artist he wanted to and to make whatever style of music he wanted to. And the same for me with the drawing and the characters. Suddenly, we were given free rein to do whatever we wanted to do and not answer to anybody but ourselves. And that's a huge privilege, you know, at that point in your career, to suddenly, you know, to have a deal with a record company who love your idea and to be in a position to do whatever the fuck you want with your friend. And so off we went, and that was the creation of Gorillaz.
That was Jamie Hewlett, and his eponymous book is out now, published by Taschen. Now, to end the show, of course, it's time for our global countdown. Fernando, who we just heard from, he's always busy, so we've given him a week off. In his stead stands, or sits, I should say more accurately, Monocle's Bill Luthi. Hello, Bill. Where are we headed?
Well, as listeners of Monocle 24 will know, I love Asian pop music. So okay. We're going to China.
Great. And we're going to be following our usual form of counting down 5 through 1.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you get the ball rolling?
We're starting with number 5, Core One, with Can't Help Falling in Love with You.
Sounds like a ballad. Am I wrong?
A bit, yeah. It's not a cover of that Christmas song.
Okay.
But it's not great, so I think we're just going to move over it. They're a boy band.
Very diplomatically put, Bill. Carry on.
They sound like every boy band you'd ever imagine. So, we're going to skip straight to 4, because 4 is interesting. It's by an artist called Alan, okay. Not
wow.
A very Chinese name.
Not what I was expecting, yeah.
Who is a young lady.
Okay.
Full of surprises.
And the song is called Beauty Valley. She's interesting. She's 30 and she's from Tibet, which is kind of in the Chinese market. It's interesting that she's doing quite well.
Yeah.
She's been releasing songs for a while. She releases in China and Korea, and she does quite well there. She's been away for a few years, and she's back with this song. In the video, she's dressed in like kind of traditional Tibetan dress, and it is a ballad, but it's quite a good one. It's a bit kind of Disney-esque.
Okay.
And then towards the end of the song, she starts doing what you might call more traditional singing. Of which I think we have a clip. What do you make of that?
Powerful. I don't know how poppy it was. I was slightly taken aback by that.
I mean... I think it's a compliment. If I heard that on the new Björk album, I go, that's pretty good.
Good point, Toby, good point.
Maybe she's doing a new, she's featuring on that album.
Tribute act, if you will. Let's rattle through, Bill. What's number three?
Number three, there's a lot of rap in this one. This is an artist called Stanny. So the word Danny with mm-hmm. an S on the beginning. Stanny mm-hmm. Lee, a song called Animal. Stanny Lee is a rapper, and this is her highest charting position. It's pretty good.
Okay.
We can give it a listen, actually.
Let's have a quick burst of it. Certainly, quite a few contrasts in this top five. I can't chart an obvious lineage through Alan's work to Stanny's, but...
I don't know. I think that one's interesting. It's distinctive. Got like that kind of 90s rave bit, yeah. and then it yeah. breaks down into a more kind of noughties 2010s.
So Solidy sounded a little
yeah.
bit.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of UKG, isn't it? Yeah.
Bill, you can't remember the 90s rave scene. Don't try and pull the wool over my eyes for 1 second. Let's head up to the... as we get close to the top of the charts.
Number two... Timmy Zhu. Last time I came on to talk about the Chinese chart, he was in it as well. He cannot keep himself out of the charts. He's 23. He's an actor. He's an entrepreneur. He releases these songs. I'm going to be very rude. I think this song is like trash. I just like, okay. yeah.
It's important as a critic to be candid, Bill. I think we can all agree on that.
The way he gets into the charts and is by like just copying everything. It sounds... I said that the number five band were a bit like every band ever. This is like... it's like throwing all types of music into a big pot, stirring it up and pouring out a big mess.
Generica Records, perhaps.
I think so. Okay. We can give it a listen if you want.
I don't know. Maybe we should just move on. I don't want to upset our listeners'
ears.
Oh, I
think I want to listen.
Okay, let's have a quick listen. So this is
pure genericism.
Exactly.
Here we go. Here's Timmy for you. Something, Kathleen, I don't know, strangely familiar about that.
Yes.
Bill's not wrong, is he?
No, not at all.
Okay, Bill, what about the top of the pile? Is this something that delights you or disappoints you?
Number one is a treat okay. for the ears. You'll know EXO, Tom, won't you?
Oh, yes, K-pop stalwarts.
Yeah, well, so EXO mm-hmm. are huge. It's a band, but there are two sections. So there's like there's the EXO-M and EXO-K. M is the Mandarin version, K is the Korean version. They're kind of the same band, they sing the same songs, but they do it in all different languages. This guy, Lay, is one of the Mandarin group.
Ah, okay.
He's had a couple of singles. His last single went to number one briefly in the iTunes chart in the US. So
wow.
It's a pretty big deal. Okay. And this is his song called Sheep. And I'm not really sure what he's on about. The song opens with, "Look, I'm the lead sheep in China."
Okay. I've looked sort of loose at farming theme, perhaps.
Well,
we're
don't
not
know,
sure.
Because here, being a sheep means like you follow the crowd.
Indeed.
And
you're not the lead.
Yeah.
Mm. No.
So being the lead crowd follower doesn't really make sense. But in the video, there's loads of like red stuff. He talks about being red. Red is like money and prosperity in China. Apparently, there's like this is quite technical. There's a translation issue with sheep and goat, and the goat zodiac sign also means like prosperity. So I think it might be a thing
I see.
About being prosperous, which makes sense. It's a rap. He's rapping about being rich. Go
so there maybe should yeah. be caprine yeah. rather than ovine notes to this. If we're getting a bit Latin-y with it.
Yeah.
Bill, do we take a quick listen? I mean, do you advise that? I think
we can hear a burst. Go.
Let's hear a burst of sheep. Yeah. Well, we're definitely enjoying
brilliant.
That one. Kathleen, Toby, rushing out to get straight on your iTunes to download that one.
It now.
I've
yeah.
got to listen to that, all
okay.
of that.
Well,
it's really good. And the video has got loads of hot stuff in. So there's a bit with a microwave. There's a bit with a sauna.
A microwave?
Yeah, they make popcorn in the microwave, and then when it explodes, popcorn comes out, and there's a red sheep in the microwave.
Wow.
That's worth a look.
I'm heading straight onto onto the YouTube for that one. Bill Luthi, thanks for guiding us through. What a tip-top countdown. That's the end of the programme. Thanks to Bill. And thanks, of course, to my guests, both Kathleen Fox-Davis and Toby Earle. The programme was produced by Holly Fisher. I'm Tom Edwards. To play us out, well, we must have more sheep. Let's leave Lay to play us out. Thanks for listening. Baby,